Hello and welcome to the Scholar's Circle, scholarscircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we continue to trace the birth of free speech protection in the U.S., a country that for decades prosecuted dissenters. What caused the radical turnaround by the Supreme Court to support free speech? Then, can historical trauma be used as a means of uniting humanity rather than dividing humanity? Joining us now is Thomas Healy, professor of law at Seton Hall Law School and author of The Great Dissent, How Oliver Wendell Holmes Changed His Mind and Changed the History of Free Speech in America. His book traces where the shift in U.S. law and culture began to form from prosecuting dissenters to protecting free speech. Welcome back, Thomas Healy.
Thank you.
Last week, we were discussing how for decades the U.S. had been prosecuting dissent. Supreme Court has been siding with the U.S. government, upholding the prosecutions. But things began to change because of Oliver Wendell Holmes' encounters with a handful of people. We talked about Billings' Learned Hand, and then we just started to talk about this young man, Harold Laski, and the impact that he made on him. Let's review what the times were like.
Sure. This is all taking place in 1918, 1919, the end of World War One, the beginning of the first Red Scare. During World War One, the government had pretty vigorously prosecuted dissent under the Espionage and Sedition Acts, which essentially made it a crime to say almost anything critical of the government or the war. Nearly 2,000 indictments were brought under the two laws. You had people going to jail for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, including Eugene Debs, who was the leader of the Socialist Party at the time. And the lower courts had, for the most part, been upholding these convictions. And there were a number of cases that came before the Supreme Court in the spring of 1919, and the Supreme Court also upheld the convictions in opinions written by Holmes. And the court had some more cases that it was facing in the fall of 1919 that were sort of left over from the war. These were appeals from convictions that were brought during the war. But during 1919, the first Red Scare is underway, and this sort of fear has been transformed from a fear of German spies or sympathizers into a fear of Bolshevists. And so Congress is launching investigations. The Attorney General is trying to stamp out dissent. A young individual in the Department of Justice by the name of J. Edgar Hoover is beginning to compile lists of people who are viewed as subversive. And it's in this context that some progressives are starting to make more vocal arguments in favor of free speech.
And so last week we talked about this chance encounter with the state judge, Billings' Learned Hand, and then Harold Laski, and they were starting to try to persuade Oliver Wendell Holmes that his position up until this point had perhaps not been the correct position on speech.
Absolutely. So Holmes ran into Hand on a train between New York and Boston in the summer of 1918, and Hand had launched into a speech about the value of tolerance, to which Holmes had replied that Hand was striking at the sacred right to kill the other fellow when he disagrees. Hand is shocked into silence and begins this correspondence with Holmes in which he is trying to make him more sensitive to the value of free speech and the value of tolerance. And then some other individuals get in on this lobbying effort. Foremost among them is Harold Laski, who was at the time a young 24-year-old political theorist and economist who was from England but was an instructor at Harvard. And he had met Holmes through one of his colleagues at Harvard, a professor at the law school named Felix Frankfurter, who, of course, went on to sit on the Supreme Court in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And both Laski and Frankfurter were connected to a magazine called The New Republic, which was new at the time, had been founded in 1914. Learned Hand had connections to The New Republic. And both Frankfurter and Laski were also connected to a house in Washington, D.C. that was known as the House of Truth, This was a house in DuPont Circle that served as a kind of literary or legal salon. It was a gathering place for young journalists and diplomats and lawyers in Washington. And it was at this house and through these individuals that Lasky and Frankfurter became friends with Holmes. Lasky and Frankfurter, really, of all these individuals, are the two that are the closest to Holmes. And Holmes has almost a paternal relationship with these two, especially with Lasky. And so they became very close very quickly.
Let's talk about some of the cases. Up until these encounters, and even up until the Abrams case, Holmes had been supporting the juries that had been convicting people who were dissenting against the government. Now, Learned Hand had a case in which he made this argument, the masses case.
Yes.
And he made this argument about speech to Oliver Wendell Holmes in the encounter and in some letters following. But Oliver Wendell Holmes's position in these other cases, what were these cases and what did he say?
Well, these were cases in which socialists, they were almost all socialists, and a fair number of them were German socialists who, you know, were suspected of having some sympathies with the German cause. These individuals had criticized the war, had argued, as most socialists did, that the war was being fought for the benefit of Wall Street, and that, you know, the working class was being sent off to die so that the wealthy plutocrats could benefit. And in the Schenck case, they had, these were some socialists in Philadelphia who had printed up some flyers and distributed them, and had essentially urged people to exercise their right to claim conscientious objector status to the draft. They had circulated these pamphlets. They made them available at their bookstore downtown, and they had actually mailed some of them to draftees, to men who had been drafted. And when officials became aware of this, they raided their offices, they seized these flyers, and they charged them with violating the Espionage Act. Eugene Debs was one of the cases. He had given a speech in Canton, Ohio, that was, you know, basically a stump speech in advance of the fall 1918 midterm elections, and he had made similar arguments about how the war was being fought for the bankers and the working man was being sent off to die. And in a case called Frohwerk, this involved an editor of a German language newspaper in Kansas City who had written editorials that were critical of the war. And all of these individuals were prosecuted. They got, some of them got 5-10 years in jail for engaging in this speech. And when these cases came before the Supreme Court in the spring of 1919, the court voted unanimously to uphold the convictions, and Holmes wrote the opinions. And consistent with his beliefs up to this point, he rejected their free speech claims. He said in a passage that has become famous, he said that free speech doesn't protect a person in falsely shouting fire in a crowded theater, and analogized what these individuals were doing to falsely shouting fire in a crowded theater. He also did something in the Schenck case which was interesting. Prior to that point, most courts had analyzed these free speech claims under a test that was known as the bad tendency test, which meant that if your speech had any tendency to cause any sort of harm, it could be punished. Holmes actually articulated a slightly different test. He said that the test was whether or not the speech posed a clear and present danger. And this was completely novel formulation. Those words had never appeared in that form before. And on their face, they sound like they're quite speech protective. Like, in order to be punished, the danger has to be clear, it can't be speculative, and it has to be present, meaning immediate. It can't be some remote danger in the future. But Holmes, after stating that test, he didn't apply it to the facts of any of these cases. He just affirmed the convictions, which was kind of puzzling. And as soon as these decisions come down, he gets inundated with letters of criticism about the decisions, and his friends start to sort of push him as well. He gets a letter from Learned Hand, who takes issue with the way Holmes formulates the test. He gets a letter from Harold Lasky, who is also concerned about the amount of discretion that Holmes is giving the government in punishing people who criticize the war. And you start to see Holmes beginning to get a little defensive and to try to distance himself a little bit from these decisions and his responses to Lasky and Hand and to others of his friends. He writes off a series of letters to various friends defending his decisions, but at the same time trying to distance himself a little bit from those decisions and saying that he would support a pardon, you know, if Wilson wants to pardon Debs, that would be a good thing. And so you start to see Holmes moving a little bit in the direction of free speech after these decisions in the spring of 1919.
Now, Louis Brandeis, who was also a justice who came onto the court, had also begun to lobby and discuss cases with Oliver Wendell Holmes. What impact do you think Justice Brandeis had on him?
Well, Brandeis definitely had a lot of influence on Holmes in general. They actually knew each other from years before. They had both attended Harvard Law School, although not at the same time. Brandeis was younger than Holmes. But after Brandeis got to Cambridge and enrolled at Harvard Law School, he met Holmes, and the two became friends in Boston. Their careers diverged at a certain point. Holmes sat on the Massachusetts Supreme Court, while Brandeis went into private practice and became quite successful and quite rich. But when Brandeis was appointed to the Supreme Court in 1916, the two quickly renewed their friendship. And Holmes had a lot of admiration for Brandeis. He thought he was incredibly smart, and he liked the fact that Brandeis was open to larger ideas and theories in a way that he felt the other justices on the Supreme Court weren't at that time. And so Brandeis, who was quite progressive and liberal at the time, he starts nudging Holmes to the left on various issues, and he does this with respect to free speech. There are two decisions, actually, or two dissenting opinions that Holmes writes in 1918 that aren't directly about free speech. They're sort of tangentially related, but he writes these opinions because of pressure that he comes under from Brandeis. He actually tells Harold Lasky in a letter that he was, and he uses the word cat-spawned, that he was cat-spawned by Brandeis into writing a dissent on burning themes. And he's referring there to a dissenting opinion he writes in the winter of 1918, the fall of 1918. And so Brandeis is sort of pushing Holmes a little bit, although Brandeis's views at the time were not on free speech, were not fully formed. He actually joins the court's opinions in the spring of 1919 that uphold these convictions. And Brandeis is also preoccupied at the time with the Zionist movement. He spends the summer of 1919 in Europe and in Israel, or what later becomes Israel. And so he has some influence on Holmes, but I don't think he has as much influence as people like Lasky and Hand do. And what Lasky does is to really sort of lead this effort. He feeds Holmes one book after another on tolerance and political liberalism. He sends Holmes a book that's a biography of Adam Smith, who was the founder of laissez-faire capitalism and the idea of free trade, which comes out in Holmes' Abrams Dissent when he talks about the free trade and ideas. Lasky sends Holmes articles that are written in the Harvard Law Review and the New Republic arguing for an expansive view of free speech. And he even does something that, you know, by today's sort of judicial standards of ethics would, I think, be considered quite questionable. In the summer of 1919, he arranges a meeting between Holmes and a young professor at Harvard Law School by the name of Zachariah Chafee, who was an emerging free speech scholar and had criticized Holmes' decision in the Debs case. And Lasky invites the two men to his bungalow in Rockport during the summer to have tea and to meet and to talk about these issues. And before the meeting, he writes Chafee, and he says that he's given Holmes Chafee's article, and he says, "We must fight on it. I'll go to the stake for every word." So there's a sense in which he really is trying to make a real concerted effort to change Holmes's views on free speech.
Let me just remind listeners that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Thomas Healy about his new book, The Great Dissent, How Oliver Wendell Holmes Changed His Mind and Changed the History of Free Speech in America. Fast forward now to the Abrams case, because this is where he takes his old phrase, the clear and present danger that he used in Schenck, and kind of turned it around to be a pro-free speech phrase. What happened?
Well, you're absolutely right that clear and present danger, you know, in the earlier cases hadn't really meant much because Holmes hadn't applied it, you know. A legal test is only as strong as the application of it. And Holmes hadn't applied it. But what happened is, after those cases came out in the spring of 1919, Zachariah Chafee, this professor at Harvard Law School, is writing a law review article about free speech and about these cases. And he's looking for a way to argue for a speech protective test. And he's reading these opinions, and he starts thinking about that phrase, clear and present danger. And he starts realizing that, actually, if that phrase is applied, that it could be a very speech-protective test. And so that's what he argues for in his article that summer in the Harvard Law Review. And he sort of makes a claim that's kind of disingenuous. He makes the claim that, in fact, the court has already embraced a speech-protective test. That this test that Holmes announced, that's a great test, and that the court has already sort of embraced it. When, in fact, Holmes had just sort of tossed it off, you know, kind of casually, almost cavalierly. But Chafee's smart, and he realizes that, you know, that he can make something of this. And Learned Hand recognizes what he's doing. Hand writes to him later and says that, you know, Chafee has taken what has fallen from heaven and treated it like manna. And, you know, so basically took advantage of this phrase. And so then, over tea, I think Chafee is trying to encourage Holmes to treat this phrase seriously and, you know, to actually give it some real teeth. And so that's sort of what sets the stage for the Abrams case in the fall of 1919. This is a case that is, you know, in some ways similar to the earlier cases. The defendants are a group of Russian immigrants who are active in the anarchist community that was quite vibrant at the time in New York City. And they had circulated some flyers that did not criticize the war against Germany. What they criticized was the Wilson administration's intervention in the Russian Revolution. And the Wilson administration had sent troops into Russia, and these Russian immigrants thought that these troops were being sent to crush the revolution. And so they argued that Wilson was a hypocrite and a liar and a coward, and that this was going to, you know, end up destroying this revolution. And they encouraged workers in the munitions factories in New York City to go on strike. Now, of course, you know, a strike in the munitions factories would not only affect military intervention in Russia, it would have consequences for the war against Germany. And so they were prosecuted under the Sedition Act. There was a provision in there about how you couldn't encourage or hinder the production of any sort of munitions that were necessary for the war. And so they were prosecuted, and they were sentenced to 20 years in jail, or at least most of them were. And this case came before the Supreme Court in the fall of 1919. Now, to most members of the court, this case was no different than the earlier cases. A majority of the court upholds the convictions. Seven members of the court uphold the convictions, citing Holmes's opinions from earlier in the year. But Holmes writes a dissenting opinion, and it's joined by Brandeis. And what's really interesting about this dissenting opinion is that you can see in this dissent the influence of this sort of behind-the-scenes lobbying effort over the past year by Holmes's friends to change his mind. But there's something else that's going on here behind the scenes as well. And I think it's important to understand that, because I think it really makes clear that this dissenting opinion that Holmes writes is not just a kind of academic exercise, but it has a real personal component. During the year 1919, during the Red Scare, two of Holmes's friends, Lasky and Frankfurter, they came under attack for their own somewhat radical views. Lasky for his Marxist leanings, and Frankfurter for his support of labor unions. And both men who taught at Harvard, and Harvard was in the midst of a fundraising campaign, and the conservative alumni at Harvard were upset about the activities of these two men and threatened to withhold their contributions if the two men weren't fired. And Holmes found out about this, and in the spring of 1919, he wrote letters on their behalf to the Harvard president and to the Harvard Law School Alumni Association, and that seemed to help. But in the fall of 1919, Lasky came under attack again because when the Boston police went on strike, Lasky came out in support of them. And the Harvard Board of Trustees launched an investigation to determine whether he was fit to remain on the faculty. And so at the very moment that the court is considering, you know, the scope of free speech, the ability of people to engage in dissent, one of Holmes's very close friends, an individual that he viewed as a sort of son, is under attack for his own, you know, dissenting opinions. And in fact, the very week that the court hears arguments in this Abrams opinion, Frankfurter pays a visit to the editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine and is furious about the attacks on Lasky and the general attitude of intolerance in the country. And the editor of the Atlantic tells Frankfurter that he will print an article on tolerance if Frankfurter can get one from someone like Holmes, or he refers to Charles Eliot, who was the former president of Harvard. He said, somebody who counts. And what he meant by that is a member of the establishment, a member of the old guard, someone who people will listen to. So Frankfurter passes that information on to Lasky, and both of these men write letters to Holmes the very week that the Abrams case is being argued, and they ask Holmes if he will write an article like this on tolerance. Now, Holmes declines. It was a sort of odd request, you know, to ask a justice of the Supreme Court to write an article for a magazine about tolerance. He declines, but he makes clear that he's troubled by the attacks on Lasky and that he's not afraid to speak his mind. And then he writes the dissent in Abrams. And he tells Frankfurter in a letter that he wrote the dissent quasi in furor, which is Latin for as if possessed. And when the dissent comes out, his friends, Lasky, Frankfurter, Walter Lippmann, Herbert Crowley, Roscoe Pound, the dean of Harvard Law School, Learned Hand, they all write him these letters that are incredibly, they're filled with, you know, incredible gratitude, and they're incredibly poignant letters telling Holmes, you know, how grateful they are for what he has done. And the implication is that he's done something for them. So I think what's really interesting about this dissenting opinion is Holmes is writing it technically in defense of these Russian immigrants, but from the perspective of his friends, they viewed it as a defense of them. So you have this, you know, this incredibly influential Supreme Court opinion that really, I think, is motivated in part by very personal considerations.
Thomas Healy, two things I'd like to end on. One is, how long did it take before protecting speech went from being a dissent to then being the law based on, essentially, Oliver Wendell Holmes' dissent as the starting point? But then also, how much do you think this story tells us about the making of law?
Well, the path from this dissent of Holmes, and it is a dissent, right? He doesn't make the law in this with this dissenting opinion.
Exactly.
You know, he introduces the notion of the marketplace of ideas. He gives some real bite to this notion of clear and present danger, but he's in dissent. You know, that's not the law of the land at the time. And it takes quite a while for these views to become the majority view. Holmes and Brandeis, they continue to dissent in a number of cases over the next decade. They continue to insist that clear and present danger, as they understand it, is the applicable test, and that speech should not be punished unless it poses, you know, a clear and present danger, that we should rely on the marketplace of ideas, that the remedy for speech that you disagree with is not censorship, it's more speech. You know, if you don't like what somebody says, then respond to that with more speech. And so they continue to dissent in very powerful language over the next decade. And you gradually see the court becoming more responsive and receptive to these ideas. And it's really in the late 1930s, early 1940s, that the court embraces clear and present danger. But even then, we go through some later struggles with free speech. Obviously, during the Cold War and McCarthyism, the court backslides a little bit. And it's really not until the late 1960s, in a case called Brandenburg, where the court finally sort of embraces the strong version of the clear and present danger test. They call it, they use different words for it by this time, but it really is Holmes's test made even stronger. And so, you know, as a kind of legal matter, it takes, basically 50 years until this is the law of the land as far as the Supreme Court is concerned. I think in the culture, I think, these ideas, they make some headway earlier, and then, of course, there's some backsliding during McCarthyism. But these ideas of, the marketplace of ideas and the free trade in ideas and clear and present danger, these are not just legal concepts. They are, for us now, part of our cultural vocabulary. They're part of the way we think about ourselves, and they're part of our identity as a nation.
You look at this story. What do we draw from this in terms of the making of law? This story is partly about friendship.
I think it's a huge part of the story is about friendship and about relationships. I think that there's certainly an intellectual component to this lobbying campaign. These friends of Holmes are certainly appealing to him, on an intellectual level. But it seems to me that it's really only when these issues become very personal and concrete to Holmes that he is ready to fully embrace these ideas.
So could it happen again in another decade with a Roberts Court justice, for example?
I mean, I think it can. I think that, one of the major points that Holmes made throughout his career was about how law is made. A famous line from one of Holmes's books is that the life of the law has not been logic, it has been experience. And what he meant by that is that, we don't make the law, courts don't make the law strictly as a logical matter, that judges are influenced by all sorts of other factors, including, the prejudices that they share with their fellow men, including, their biases and the people they know. And I think that this experience that Holmes goes through is a perfect illustration of that. And I think it happens all the time. I think that, there are justices on the Supreme Court now who acknowledge that their views on various issues, such as, say, same-sex marriage, are at least partially influenced by the fact that they know people who are gay, and that matters to them. And I think it's inescapable. I think anybody who tries to claim that judges decide cases in a vacuum and that their personal background and experiences and relationships don't play a role, I think those people are kidding themselves. And so, yes, I think it is possible that, in some way that we may never be aware of, current and future justices could be influenced in ways similar to how Holmes was influenced.
Thank you so much, Thomas Healy. The book again is called The Great Dissent: How Oliver Wendell Holmes Changed His Mind and Changed the History of Free Speech in America. We've been speaking with Thomas Healy, the author of the book. When we come back, what does it mean to colonize or decolonize our memories? Stay tuned.
Thank you.
You are listening to the Scholar's Circle, scholarscircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Last week, we began discussing how memory entrepreneurs attempt to manipulate memory for their own political gain. This week, we continue that conversation, but looking at historical trauma and how it can also be used as a means of uniting humanity. With us are three experts. Duvile Boudrite is a professor of political science at Georgia Gwinnett College. She's the author of Taming Nationalism and co-editor of the collected volume Memory and Trauma in International Relations. Douglas Becker also joins us. He's a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California and the author of the book chapter Memory and Trauma as Elements of Identity in Foreign Policy Making. Also with us is Jessica Ochter. She's a professor of political science and public service at the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga, and she's the author of The Politics of Haunting and Memory in International Relations. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you back, Duvile Boudrite, and it's great to have you with us, Jessica Ochter. Last week, we started talking about this idea of historical memory as something that is politicized, sometimes intentionally, but sometimes not intentionally, and how our memories have become almost a battleground, a contested battleground, in order to put forward policies and that sort of a thing. I thought perhaps what we should do is recap the nuts and bolts of what we're talking about when we talk about memory politics. Duvile Boudrite, why don't you start us?
I think that one thing to remember about memory politics is that memory politics primarily refers to instrumentalization of memory, which is to say that very often politicians and also agents of memory, sometimes they use past to make a certain point, but also to become more powerful. So I think that a good starting point thinking about memory politics would be a classical definition of politics: who gets what, when, and how. And in this particular case, we can definitely think of examples when politicians trying to increase their own power, they go out of their way to instrumentalize the past. And we talked about several examples. One example that came up during our previous discussion was about post-Soviet politics and Putin definitely making a great use of the past. One of my favorite examples talking about Russia would be, of course, the Great Patriotic War, which many Russians still associate with victory, with the greatness of their country.
So it's really, in essence, framing, as we call it in the media world, where you may take a piece of history and leave out some other histories or potentially rework it in one favor or another.
That's very true. I recall that during the program last week, we were also talking about strategic forgetting. And I think this is a crucial point that we cannot talk about remembering without talking about forgetting. So very often, we also talked about the case of the Crimea, that certain memories are left out. And I recall remembering the example of the Tatars in Crimea, whose memories, for example, very traumatic memories about deportation very often are out of the picture. So yes, I believe that your comparison, Maria, with framing is a great one.
Jessica Ochter, what would you add?
Yeah, I want to emphasize what Duvile has said about the strategic forgetting issue, because I think for me, it's very much about what official memorialization that is oriented towards specific political ends actually leaves out, either on purpose in a sort of strategic way to promote a specific political narrative, or sometimes just by virtue of the nature of memory and forgetting, that there are just things we forget. And I think a lot of that, for the cases that I usually look at, have to do with the forgetting of colonial histories and that sort of thing. And it's one of the reasons why I'm particularly interested in some of the everyday practices of resistance to the instrumentalization of memory. If you have politicians that are engaged in this instrumentalization of memory for particular political ends, what escapes those efforts? In what ways are individuals engaging in memory practices that can resist that? And we've seen a little bit of that in the focus on the Tatars, as Duvile brought up, but I think you can come up with that in any case where you're seeing these excesses that escape the efforts of politicians to create and instrumentalize, particular memories. And for me, that's what's most interesting in this tension between memorialization and strategic forgetting, is what can't be forgotten, what individuals don't forget, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. A couple of things. One, you mentioned colonization. Really important. I was sort of thinking in terms, as I was reading everybody's work and some of the material that Dovile had sent, about the idea of colonizing our minds, just sort of an extension of colonization in a way. Would you say there's some evidence to that?
I think there is. What we usually see with official memory narratives is a very, very specific story of what has happened that's oriented towards legitimizing particular policies, and individuals often buy into that. It's something that I've seen in talking with survivors of genocide and that sort of thing, that they are often very much participatory in the national narratives. The concerns about genocide denial and those sorts of things, and you see a lot of those same denial narratives even in cases that aren't genocide cases, where there's a lot of concern about the alternative memory narrative that is usually posited as being a radical form of denial of the historical record. So I think there is a lot about people buying into these kinds of memory narratives. It is mind colonization in the sense that you spoke about, because for a lot of people, the memory narrative is not just a memory narrative. It's a story about what actually happened. It's a story of historical truth that's intimately associated with how they view themselves in the world, how they view their social and political communities. It's an identity issue. So the individual and their participation in these wider political narratives is a salient issue of their own identity and also of larger community and political identities, I think.
Identity is exactly what Doug looks at in terms of how it is used, how it is formed, but to put forward foreign policies and other public policies, particularly on trauma. Doug Becker, what's a recent example of that that you can think of?
Specifically, talking about trauma and discussing genocide, immediately what comes to mind is rwandan foreign policy and the current leadership of Paul Kagame, that there's two specific ways, instrumentalist ways, in which President Kagame has been using historical memory, the memory of the genocide. The first is the blunt criticism of his human rights record in Eastern Congo by crafting the narrative of Rwandan intervention as a means to try to avoid a second genocide. That, yes, there may be Rwandans in Eastern Congo, he equivocates in this, but when he does admit there are Rwandans in Eastern Congo, these are, you know, people who are trying to root out Hutu genocidaires and ensure that the Hutu don't return to commit genocide a second time, as a kind of convenient justification for an aggressive foreign policy, for concern, you know, a plunder of Eastern Congo resources, etc. He also uses it as a way to blunt criticism, particularly from Western governments, but even from Western human rights organizations, Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch, and absolutely from the UN, by stating, you were silent 20 years ago when genocide was being waged in Rwanda. Therefore, you have no credibility to criticize me today and to try to take some sort of moral high ground. So there's a little bit of a hierarchy. He certainly uses this against Western governments, absolutely against Western European governments like France, has been known to use this against the U.S., even sort of extending it to human rights groups and say, you were silent when we most needed you. So what justification do you have to criticize us for human rights today? And then finally, domestically, some of his policies that are being described as autocratic or not terribly supportive of freedom of speech, et cetera, are couched in what is termed the anti-genocide law, which initially meant that genocide denial in Rwanda was criminalized. And Europeans hear this, and it sounds very similar to the criminalization of the denial of the Holocaust. And so it wins international support as well as domestic support. But he's increasingly using this against any critics of his government. Any criticism of his government falls into this category of genocide denial as a way to stamp out free speech. I mean, even simple statements like, well, you know, Hutu were also killed during the genocide, which is actually factually correct. Statements like that have been used to shut down and even imprison some of his political opponents by saying you've run afoul of the anti-genocide law, the form of genocide denial. And so he's using this as a way to justify what's really becoming increasingly autocratic and even dictatorial types of policies.
A little bit reminiscent to some degree about the Turkish denial of the Armenian genocide as well. The argument, oh, well, Turks died as well, or there were some Armenians that killed some Turks as well, but forgetting the bigger picture of the planned annihilation of all the Armenians.
Actually, one key difference there I would like to point out, though, is that Hutu moderates were actually targeted by Hutu genocide. And so the more extremist Hutu groups also targeted political opponents of the genocide within the Hutu community, which is a little bit different than the Turks trying to argue that there wasn't genocide against Armenians because it was the middle of a war and there was resistance and some Turks died as a result of, you know, of a civil war, which is separate from the actual, you know, campaign that the Turkish government waged against, that the Ottoman government waged against the Armenians.
We started last week talking about this concept of hauntology. And since we have Jessica Ochter with us now, I understand this concept actually comes from Derrida. Can you help us understand what you mean by hauntology and what are the politics of it?
I think it actually transitions nicely from what Doug was just talking about, the legal context of this sort of genocide laws in Rwanda and that sort of thing. One of the things that I found when I was in Rwanda is that beyond this legal context, when I talk to survivors or other members of the Rwandan population, the specter of genocide denial sort of remains in a very salient way, where everyone I talked to was very, very concerned that genocide denial was pervasive outside of Rwanda, even though statistically speaking, that's not accurate. But people are very concerned that this narrative persisted. And so their own sentiments about the pervasiveness of genocide denial actually legitimated particular policies. So in that sense, you see the specter of genocide denial and the way that that sort of haunts in legitimizing particular policies. But I think for me, hauntology is a lot about the things that we don't usually pay attention to when it comes to questions of historical memory, and particularly the excesses of these sorts of memory narratives and memory practices, the ghostly, the things that haunt us that are not necessarily captured by standard forms of memorial logic. And for me, that's a lot about these questions of shared human vulnerability and in what way our understandings of the vulnerability we all have as human beings allow us to move beyond some of these totalizing memory narratives. So it's about being haunted by the things we should be haunted by. In that sense, for me, it's an ethical commitment. The interesting thing is the concept originates with Derrida, but he doesn't really pursue it much except in the context of discussing Marxism. And he doesn't really look at it in the context of memory. But for me, how can you look at these cases of post-atrocity or of deaths and not pay attention to all of these sorts of ghostly voices and ghostly stories that aren't captured by the memory narratives that are typically told of these situations and of the stories that are used in the political context, in the context of the instrumentalization of memory that we were talking about earlier. So for me, being haunted is an ethical issue as well as a sort of methodological one, I guess, and theoretical one. It's about paying attention to a lot of these issues, about paying attention to the everyday memory practices of Rwandans instead of just the totalizing memory narrative that we usually discuss and pay attention.
One of the things I found really interesting and compelling with your work dealt with how you put these three cases together and how you dealt with when you couldn't bury your dead, for example. So 9/11 was one of your case studies alongside Rwanda, but also the immigrants, the migrants trying to cross into the United States, and how when you can't bury your dead, when you can't even see the body, when the body is either obliterated or if it's disappeared, what that actually does to people's trauma and memory as well, and how it's an exercise of power, like beyond political power. Can you talk about those things?
One of the interesting things for me about paying attention to things that we're not usually haunted by is that it raises all of these complex questions about the agency of the dead, because usually the dead are relegated to the private realm So after genocide, we talk about the institutional changes associated with transitional justice and the rebuilding of the state. But we talk a lot less about the material after effects. What do you do with nearly 1 million dead bodies that are sometimes disaggregated and buried who knows where? And some of them are buried and some of them aren't buried. And the same thing sort of recurs with the other cases I looked at. You have the material after effects of atrocity or death, but we don't tend to pay as much attention to those as we do to the institutional context. So for me, what's interesting is the dead body as a member of the political community in some way. Our identities, as you said, are attached to what happens to our dead, that we treat our dead in a way that may be different from their dead. And one of the examples of that is has been the movement to repatriate undocumented immigrants who have died in crossing the border. So immigrants who have died in Arizona, who are buried in pauper cemeteries, there has been a huge movement in Arizona to essentially dump those bodies on the other side of the border in Mexico because of this notion that our political identity is intrinsically linked with where our bodies are buried. And those questions of identity and what happens to one's body get a lot less attention than the official memory narratives. But I think we can gain a lot of purchase on how those official memory narratives are formed and how they operate by looking at the excesses of them, the bodies that are disappeared, the things that we may not normally think of as being political in this context, but in fact actually are, and maybe allow us to reflect more on the things we have in common than the things that divide us.
And just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the politics of memory. There are three things that you made me think of. One is the politics of who matters. So there's a big part of power in saying who matters. But there are also a couple of other things. One is, you know, in the U.S., there are these mass memorial processes for homeless people. They're just buried in another mass grave, just like in an atrocity. And then there's, of course, the disappeared, people who have been disappeared by their governments and the inability to properly mourn all of that. Is that rather than having these narratives sort of compete, that they could be a way of uniting people with this shared sense of trauma and tragedy and make us more connected as humanity instead of as a battle for power. Davile, this seems to be something that you have been focused on as well. You talked about the Baltic states as an example.
The question about how to transcend divisive memories, again, it's a question that's of utmost importance to the Baltic states. We talked a little bit last time about competition of memories, and in the case of the Baltic states, in the past especially, there was a competition of the memories associated with the Holocaust, and there was another movement competing memories of Gulag, the Stalinist repression. Recently, we have seen many attempts to try to come up with different ways of mourning, the different ways of exploring these phenomena. And one example that I would like to give, it's actually a new book by Petai and Petai, two scholars from Tartu, and I just attended this book presentation, and it's called Transitional and Retrospective Justice in the Baltic States, in which they argue that we do need to embrace a relatively broad definition of transitional justice, and they mean by transitional the period of late socialism, but they also talk about retrospective justice, and retrospective justice would be going back to the times of Stalin, repressive times, and by coming up with this very interesting framework, again, they try to come up with a way to think beyond this competitiveness of memories. And I think, especially for the Baltic states, I think it's so important to acknowledge pluralism of memories, that there's just so much more than just memories about Stalinist era, than memories about World War II, and that indeed, for example, in the case of Lithuania, that the Lithuanian-Jewish relationship, for example, which very often focuses just on World War II, it's possible to also think about a longer period of time. So in that sense, I think Jessica talks about definitely bodies. I mean, by the focus on real bodies and the focus that, again, bodies should be respected, that there should be respect for every life. I think that in this field of memory studies, in the field of transitional justice studies, there are so many new interesting approaches that can help us to go beyond that competition of victimhood, which I do not think is very, again, it can be very, very not productive at all.
It's a little bit reminiscent also. I did a panel about peace between Israel and Palestine, and one of the historians said that they had jointly written a history book for Palestinians and Israelis where they had each of their narratives on one side of the page with a blank space in the middle. But because neither side really knew the other's narrative, they didn't know the other side's trauma in history, and both education ministers rejected this. So Doug Becker, let's bring you back in. Help us understand this. Why would both education ministers reject this?
You know, certainly some concern here would be, you know, the notion that there was anything, you know, that was undecided, or the idea that international actors or other actors might be able to control your narrative. I'm certain that there was concern at that level, because control of the historical narrative so much is about control of identity, control of legitimation, control of resources. Surrendering that level of control opens the door to some memories, to some remembrances that may not be the most supportive of whatever policies that you're trying to advance, or the kind of identity that you're trying to craft for your own population. So memory control in the history textbooks become the means by which you can disseminate memory, at least at some level, down generations. Although I would like to add that there's probably not a field of study, particularly among the young, that is more contested in their own communities like history. And so there's this remarkable ability for families, for communities to reassert their memory on official histories, like history textbooks might suggest. And so the textbook's a powerful tool, but it's certainly not an all-powerful memory creating tool. They tend to be much more arenas of contestation than they are deciders or arbiters of memory.
Dovile, last week, I think we started to get to, but didn't get to, the attempts to create this sort of common European memory as maybe a way of bridging across this competition. And you've given us a couple of examples. What else can you think of that this might have actually worked?
Indeed, it's a very interesting and very ambitious project to create a transnational European memory. And in the case of the European Union, we see these attempts at the European Parliament with joint commemoration days and also trying to integrate Eastern and Central European narratives. But it has not been an easy project, to say the least. Probably when thinking about transnational memory, either European transnational memory or even global transnational memory, I think we definitely need to think about the relationship between the local actors, the local imaginations, and also the transnational. So it seems to me that this transnational European memory, it cannot be successful if we only focus on the museum that tries to portray one European memory. I think that when thinking about European memory, we definitely need to think about pluralism of memories, and also perhaps think about uniting themes such as the focus on real bodies, the focus on human rights may actually be a way to, again, think about what unites these very, very diverse memories.
Well, we have just enough time to take concluding thought. Jessica, how would you wrap that up?
I think one of the dilemmas that we encounter when we think about and talk about memory is that we don't tend to pay attention to the various levels at which memory is situated. We tend to emphasize one particular memory narrative because we like to equate memory with truth when that isn't necessarily the case. And Doug was speaking about that in terms of how memory narratives are utilized in the context of the textbooks and that sort of thing. I really like this idea of pluralism of memory because it forces us and encourages us to pay attention to local practices of memorialization, not just national ones, to how transnational memorialization can interact with national and local levels, and also to the fact that people simply don't define memory and justice in the same way. And we need to start talking about justices just as we need to start talking about memories and think about how that should reflect on the way that we interpret and understand memory and also memorialization.
Doug Becker, I wonder if you have anything to add with regards to the role of apology here. You've talked a bit about it in your chapter.
Specifically, I think the role that apology can play, I think, is twofold. The first is through this recognition of agency with respect to an atrocity, it actually gives the apologizer two powerful tools, even potentially within these arenas of contestation. The first is it will build reputation for the apologizer as an actor that's prepared to recognize their own painful memories, their role in painful memories, their role in conflict in ways that will enhance their reputation. Even the notion of soft power that, sadly, a great deal of these discourses are oversimplified as to who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. And apologizing means, in essence, you're saying we were once one of the bad guys, but now we're a good guy, which I think plays a key role, for example, in the public diplomacy discourses of countries like Germany that are able to project themselves as being reconcilers, as recognizing their role in atrocities. It also gives a kind of, creates a space for the apologizer to have a profound impact on future policies. The Germans have been making this argument, but for instance, with respect to Syrian refugees in Europe, the Germans' ability to craft what exactly EU policy should be vis-a-vis refugees and the kind of authority they're speaking to it is ironically in part because the connection of apology and if ever a nation understands the need to treat refugees humanely, it's us because we've created so many refugees as a result of our foreign policies. And so it gives a level of expertise and a certain moral authority so those states can help to craft contemporary policies. The one thing I want to add to all of this is that the question I keep asking students when teaching issues of historical memory is what's at stake with respect to this memory. That memory discourses, they do exist in a kind of abstract view of identity, you know, what's remembering, a lens through which you view foreign policy. But so often memory discourses are also about resource allocation, about legitimating certain policies, about can I speak authoritatively about this community who's at risk? And what should Europe do about Syrian refugees? What should the U.S. do about Syrian refugees? You know, how should the Lebanese treat Syrian refugees, considering the substantial number of Lebanese who were also Armenian? And so fully understand what a refugee crisis looks like.
Maybe apology allows those who do have the trauma to properly grieve. And let me thank the three of you. So appreciate your joining us here on the Scholar Circle and sharing your research.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Duvile Budrite is a professor of political science at Georgia Gwinnett College. She's the author of Taming Nationalism and co-editor of the collected volume Memory and Trauma in International Relations. Douglas Becker is a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California and the author of the book chapter Memory and Trauma as Elements of Identity in Foreign Policymaking. Jessica Ochter is a professor of political science and public service at the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga, and she's the author of The Politics of Haunting and Memory in International Relations. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.